Welcome to our Farming Water Scotland podcast series. Over this series, we're looking at various mitigation options, guidance and farmers' experience to help manage and improve water quality on the farm and the surrounding area. In today's podcast, we'll be discussing sustainable bank protection with Helen Reid from SEPA and Alex Perry from SEC Consulting. I'm Fiona Salter, an environmental consultant from SEC Consulting and host for today's podcast. Now, just to start, what is sustainable bank protection?
Well, sustainable bank protection is protection that's been created using trees and vegetation. So traditionally, a lot of bank protection was put in using boulders and gabions and blockstone and sort of hard material that was introduced into the river. And so now we're using new techniques that use things like branches, whole trees, and willow spiling. So very much based on vegetation and plants. So there's a few different types of sustainable bank protection that we tend to use, and where we use them is very much linked to the energy of the river at that location. So there are some that are better on lower energy systems. So willow spiling is the first one, where you get a whole lot of stakes and you pop them along the bank and you basically weave a willow wall along the front of the bank. And this is really good, yeah, in rivers that aren't really actively active but are undergoing some like slumping or adjustment. Brash is the next one, so getting a whole lot of branches and staking those into the bank front. And so these provide the roughness, but they don't have the weight, but it's a very cheap and a very easy way. Particularly if the stakes you use are live willow, then that will sprout, and then you end up with a whole lot of live willows along the face, and you end up with really good long-term protection. The third is getting this is a more robust approach, so really good in high energy rivers where there's a lot of adjustment, quite gravelly, and that's getting large trees, and you lie the large trees along the toe of your bank. So you remove all the branches off the bottom and the back of the tree, and then you have them slightly overlapping, and then pin them or anchor them into the bank. So they sit along the bank face. And this approach is really good, and it was used in quite a few of our trial sites because it provides that weight with the log in the center. It has a really hard surface in the center, but then it has that brushy exterior that dissipates the energy. And then the final approach that was used quite a lot and is now actually being used for things like flood schemes and a whole lot of different quite sort of almost industrial locations problems, and that is using brute wads. And so what you do is you get a tree that has the root ball still attached, and you chop it off, and then you bury that trunk perpendicular to the river. And so that means that the front of the bank is basically the root wads, and it provides that wall of protection. So yeah, there are quite a range, and we use different types in different energy environments and different settings.
What kind of additional benefits do this type of techniques have compared to the harder infrastructure?
Well, there's a few. The first one is that we found it to be a lot more effective. So if you have a river bend and you put a whole lot of hard surfaces, so a whole lot of stone and rock into that bend, then when the water comes around the corner in a flood, it hits that hard surface and the energy is then reflected off, which can cause a lot of erosion and issues elsewhere. So often the bank protection can be undercut, and or we can get erosion at the up and downstream ends. And one of the real benefits of this approach is that instead of introducing a hard surface, you're introducing a much rougher surface. So you're really protecting that bank. It also means during these floods, when the really fast water comes through, rather than reflecting off the stone, it's actually moving the branches. And in doing that, it's actually using energy. So it's a far more effective way of protection because you do have this rough barrier between the bank and the fast flow. So it works really well in that. And there's also additional benefits, things like cost. It can be a lot cheaper to put in, and it can also have real biodiversity benefits. We saw when we looked at some of the sites, we could see fish swimming around hiding underneath the plants, and there were a lot of birds, like willow, in the willow trees, a lot of birds were flying around and following insects. So there's a few different reasons why we think it's a good approach.
When we look at the kind of broader context for this, obviously Scottish Government have a biodiversity and the climate crisis to deal with, kind of two interlinking priorities. And projects like this, that I'm sure we'll get into it, but there's really that opportunity to tie together habitats across the landscape to benefit the water environment, to build climate resilience into the system, as well as tackle things like diffuse pollution and runoff from farms and other land uses. So it's all for the good.
And like the scale of these types of projects, like you said, that they can be cost effective and things, but can they be like tiny little projects to help and bespoke to larger scale catchment style projects, or which one does it suit best, or is it more site specific?
I think it's more site specific. So we're not saying that this is the best thing for the river, but we're saying this is a far better thing than putting in a whole lot of hard protection. So it's about using it where you need it. So if you have a farm track that you really can't lose, then this is a really great approach to use. And in terms of the scale, so some of the ones that we've looked at, I think the shortest was 40 metres, so just a wee one. And then the longest was 230, so a lot longer. So they're really, it can, because you can kind of get it in a bit cheaper, you can do much longer stretches if you really need to. And you can also, I mean, the best thing ultimately is fencing and planting. So you can always do that along stretches that you're worried about but are not immediately undergoing massive erosion.
Yeah.
And then that safeguards it for a lot longer. So it has
a bit more proactive.
Yeah. Thinking about, well, if this bit's eroding, well, what's going to go next? And actually, if you're getting trees and vegetation into your bank, then actually those root networks really hold the banks together. And then the vegetation, the rough surface on top, protects the bank. So thinking in the long term and, you know, how you can reduce the risk in the long term.
Yeah. I think, I suppose, that goes into my next question, was like, what can farmers actually get from implementing these kind of projects on your farm? I don't know, Alex, if you want to come in and just...
Yeah, well, just to build on some of the points that Helen made there, I think historically farming's maybe had the reputation for dismissing the water environment. You know, we fence off a riverbank and we kind of leave it as is, but it really is the front line of land change on a farm. You know, the pressures of erosion, particularly of riverbanks, it's not uncommon for farmers to come to us at SAC to discuss issues with erosion and to look at their options. You know, farmers are protective of the productive ground that they've got in particular, and we want to obviously protect that and the biodiversity and climate aspects of it as well. So people are very cognizant of when they're losing land and where possible to try and prevent that.
And then obviously, Helen, we've got you here today because you've been working on the, I hope I'm going to quote this right, the Sustainable Bank Protection Trial project that SEPA have been running for the past 8 years.
About that.
Do you want, but yeah, a long time. Do you want to just give us a brief like overview of the project and then we can get into the nitty gritty?
Yeah, certainly. So it was set up sort of in conjunction with NFUS. So after Storm Frank, and NFUS were talking to SEPA and saying, you know, we have all these rivers that have done, you know, adjusted and done all this work and are threatening a whole lot of different, you know, precious lands and infrastructure. And what can we do? You know, because usually to put in bank protection, you have to apply for a license and that can take 4 months. And so it can take quite a long time. So you might have an immediate problem now, but actually you can't deal with it for a while. So off the back of that, we sort of stood back. We got given a whole lot of examples from NFUS, and so we looked at them and thought, well, what could we do to you know, protect this land where it's needed? And this seemed like an obvious solution. Mm-hmm. So there were some guys in the Lake District that had been doing a lot of it. And so it was, and that stood up to Storm Desmond, which obviously was massive down there. So it did really well. So a few of the senior people from NFUS popped down to the Lake District and were really impressed by how well these schemes had gone. But I think that the question that was left was, how well would it do in Scotland? Scotland's rivers are very mobile. There's lots of sediment. And we're getting these floods all the time. So off the back of that, we thought it would be a really good idea to actually just do a trial. So we have 8 different sites. So the most, you know, it goes right up from the Don and all the way, a few in Perthshire, three in the borders, and one in Ayrshire. And the idea was it would cover a real range of rivers, so some of these really flashy, gravelly, mobile rivers, to the Don one is, you know, a big 40-metre river on a much lower slope and dice, but actually when it floods, there's a huge amount of water coming down there. Mm-hmm. And then we also had a range of different approaches, so from the more robust to the slightly lighter touch. And this enabled us to go and actually understand how these work and how well they could work in a Scottish context.
And for the mitigating features that were put in and decided to put in, did you consult with the landowners about what the best fit were for their business? Or did you go in with the different options and then discuss it with them? And how did you get to the stage of actually implementation?
Yeah, so we didn't actually design them. So we gave the landowners a bit of money and said, go out and get these designed. We sort of have, I guess, guidance about what is sustainable and what's not, and what it includes. And then they had to go and get this bank protection designed. So it was very much based on their needs and what they needed. Quite a few were actually done by local rivers trusts, so the Dee and the Tweed particularly. Some were designed locally by the estate, and then some by consultants. So it's quite a range, and that was quite nice. And then we QA'd, so they brought the designs to us and we QA'd whether they were fit for the locations. Generally found that they were, so that was quite straightforward. Yeah.
And throughout that project, the farmers that you did actually get with to work on the project, how did those farmers get picked, or landowners or areas get picked to be within this trial?
So they were all people that had talked to NFUS and complained about having a problem. Yeah. So it was quite good in that way that they came to us with a mix of landowners that they thought were suitable. Mm-hmm. And basically we just had to see that they did have very actively eroding banks that were threatening, you know, precious agricultural land or tracks or those sorts of things that are essential for the farm.
And what do you what was the main, I suppose, reason for those farmers joining this trial? Was it land loss, or were they all totally came at it with a different problem that needed solved?
It was all just excessive bank erosion. One did have a farm track that was literally right at the bank top in the river. It joined a much larger river below, and it was just adjusting massively in that zone. So it really needed something to sort of hold the edge. So it still had room to adjust, but so it couldn't go any further without them losing that access. Some were just, agricultural land and the river just really pushing out into it and then disconnecting, the other side of the river. So there were slightly different reasons, but they were all pretty much excessive loss of land. Yeah, but when they showed us these examples, we really saw that all of the examples also were grazed to the very edge of the river. Some of them were quite poached and there was no vegetation or trees. So there was sort of the problem that they had, but also the way that the land had been managed very much led to the degree of erosion that we saw and the degree of channel adjustment.
Yeah, so that's great. So obviously we do have like the bank protection restoration projects, but you can also, like Alex was saying earlier, the fencing off and planting up, like doing these both together can have, or even on their own, can have significant effects to your field and the reduction of loss of land, even though you would be technically reducing your land from the fencing.
So all of our sites had to be fenced if there was access from stock. You know, if it was arable, obviously it's not an issue, and have that riparian veg along the top. So quite a few of them that were really effective had willow along the front, because that's so brushy and you get loads and loads of branches, and it can also grow on quite steep slopes, and then some broadleaves on the back. So they really are thinking about the long term, because over very long terms, you know, chances are some of that wood might get washed away or it might rot down. Though actually we've seen quite a few of the logs have actually been buried because the processes have changed at the bank, and we've actually seen deposition in front of them. So some of them have got grass now on top of them. So they're actually fairly protected. But it does mean when we're thinking, you know, 50 years' time, what's going to happen there? Well, you have a whole lot of trees along the bank, and just, you know, rivers with with intact riparian margins don't adjust in the same way as rivers that have just got grazed grass and bare earth.
Helen, people instinctively think that they need capital support for these kind of projects, but you talked about fencing off watercourses there. To what extent has natural succession played a role in stabilising some of these banks?
As in vegetation, natural succession?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that can be really crucial. And the ones we dealt with, we did plant to put them, you know, to get them to regenerate a lot faster. And there's things you can do that are really cheap. So willow stakes, again, if you, you know, find some willow that's local to your land and you wander down and cut some stems at an angle and put them in the ground in between November and March, then these just sprout. So that's effectively free. And some of the farmers we had, so the man on the Dawn, he then had a little bit of erosion further upstream, so he just went and cut some, put them in, and now he's got a big tree there protecting that bank. So there's stuff like that you can do, and it's really easy and cheap. Natural succession can be really good sometimes if there's a whole lot of invasive species, like Himalayan balsam, it can leave a gap for those to come up. So I think if you do put in a few trees, and sort of often shrubs are quite good because they're not too heavy on the edge of the bank, but they can provide those roots and that roughness, then it's really good for long-term protection.
How long does a willow last? Like the willow tree?
That's a good question.
Just like if it's going in to do this, like I don't actually know that, so...
I'm not entirely sure how long they last either. But a lot of the ones we've been working with, the idea is that they're coppiced after a few years. And so we looked at the maintenance landowners were carrying out. Because if you do coppice them, then they'll remain bushy and they won't turn into a really heavy tree that will then fall over. And you can also choose different types of willow that are more shrubby and they're more effective too. Yeah, and so quite a few of the sites, actually, the landowners had done nothing in the last 7 years and they were perfectly fine, but they probably are coming to the point where maybe actually just thinning them out a little bit and allowing a bit more of that coppicing is probably quite a good idea. So I think it's the way you manage them might depend on how well they work. But obviously, I would have thought at least 50 years, if not longer. And if there are issues, you just put in a few more stakes and before you know it, they've built up. But it's just, I mean, the barrier that they form on the bank face is really quite incredible. And a lot of the sites we couldn't actually get to the wood underneath because it was just so thick. The number of stems and it just really is quite incredible.
And presumably, Helen, there'll be an element of shading and temperature control because of this. You know, I quite often have conversations with Rivers Trusts here in the Southwest, and you know, salmon populations, brown trout, these are big drivers for their decision making.
Yeah, absolutely. We do need to start thinking about how we're going to keep rivers cool because it is getting hotter out there, and when you do have a river that's completely exposed, the water can actually get quite warm, and it is a real threat to salmon. But also having areas that the fish can hide from predators and cover. And again, one of the sites we looked at, you know, you look down into the water and it was teeming with fish, and the rest of the banks were completely unvegetated and you didn't see a single fish anywhere else. But just because they could hide under that bit from all the birds, it was really thick with fish. So you do see locally the fish using that habitat because it is, it's rare and it's precious.
So, they can have so many other benefits than just your land.
Yeah, and it's thinking about like filtering soil and contaminants, you know, slowing floodwater. There's loads of different benefits of trees and vegetation. Thinking about the catchment as a whole as well.
And then just looking at the project, because obviously you're in year 8 now.
Yes, I think that when we reviewed the pilots, they were between 6 and 7 years old, but we started the planning about 8 years ago. Yeah.
What do you think like the main successes of this trial have been, whether it's just been education, the actual success of the projects, the working with all the different bodies together, or it could be everything? But
I think just starting quite simply, the fact that they've done quite well is quite a big success and a bit of a relief. You know, we put a bit of money and time and effort into it, so it was nice to go and visit them a lot that we hadn't been out to for sort of 6 years. So that was quite a relief to see that they had done well. And I think, you know, it's given us a confidence and a body of knowledge, I think, about these approaches, but we've also learned what is good to do and what might not work so well. And so I think we've learned a huge amount about how we apply them and where they can be used. And yeah.
Yeah. So then looking to the challenges, what can mean challenges have occurred?
One side completely failed. And it did have some challenges. Well, it was designed and the design was really good. And then I went out after it had been installed and went, oh dear, this is not going to work. Because the construction guys had constructed it a meter above the water level. So it wasn't actually protecting the bank in any way. So I thought, oh, that's probably going to last a few months. And it lasted a year. So that was quite impressive. So they had put root rods in. So that's when you get large trees and you chop them off. And then you basically lie them perpendicular, dig a trench and put them in perpendicular to the bank face. And so the root rods are what protects the bank face. However, if you put them floating in air, floating up the bank, nowhere near where the flow is, it's not going to work. So it was our biggest one. We had another.
That's a shame.
It was a bit heartbreaking. I think we went out after construction had finished as well, so it wasn't like we could get them back in to fix it. Mm-hmm. So it was a lost opportunity and not, you know, not very fair for the landowner either. I felt sorry for him. And then we had another one where there was willow spiling, which is like a wall. We like weave a wall of willow along your bank face, and that bit's fine. And then there was a bit that jutted out into the fast flow, and he put a few root wads in there, and that bit has got nibbled away at. And so I think what we learned from that is trying to protect a sort of chunk of land that sticks out into the river doesn't really work, and you do sort of need these smoother banks because that's, you know, rivers will always nibble away at things that stick out into the faster flow until it creates a nice smooth boundary. So, but he's been, again, very good. He's moved a few willows and now it's kind of flattened off and it's a lot less of an issue now. So, and I think just realizing that when there are issues going out and just doing little bits of tweaking can be really straightforward and easy. So again, one more, the neighbor's cattle got into his field and pulled on the willow. So there's a chunk of willow missing in the middle. But again, makes it less effective. And there's been a little bit of erosion at that point. And so when we visited him, he said, oh, I've got a tree over there. I'm just going to chuck it in the gap and put some willow stakes. And, you know, that's an hour's work. And yeah, so it's just realizing.
Well, they'll get more confident with their features as well.
Absolutely.
As they learn to manage them and then can adapt it.
Yeah. And realizing it doesn't have to be a big job. And actually that farmer, he then had put in a chunk downstream off his own back. And actually that bit had done, well, I guess it hadn't been eaten by the neighbor's cattle, but it had been better. So it's trialing it and going, oh, this works. And then getting that confidence to go and do it somewhere else.
So obviously were just these specific farms. What options are available to farmers who might be interested in this type of management option on their farm? I don't know, Alex, if you want to go over this first.
Yeah, well, we're actually in quite an exciting period right now because on the 3rd of February this year, the Agri-Environment Climate Scheme returned for a 2025 round of funding. The deadline for environmental applications is the 12th of June this year, which gives applicants, farmers, plenty of time to consider their options. But within the Agri-Environment Climate Scheme, there are options aimed at improving the water environment, whether that's on the farm steading or at field scale. So I think in terms of what we're discussing today, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about water margin management in grassland and arable fields. But there's also options available there for the protection of riverbanks. So as a kind of capital option. So there's support out there and people shouldn't be afraid to look and see what's available for them, particularly if they know that they've identified an issue.
What would be their first point of call, like if they have found an issue?
So if you've found an issue, I would like to think that you might look at some of the materials that Farming and Water Scotland have that is available on the Farm Advisory Service website, and obviously you can get in touch with SEPA as well. But any farmer that's looking to see what options are available for their holding, there is a spatial targeting tool that's available on the website. And by putting in your main location code, you'll see what options are available for your business. It might be that some of these options are not available, and in some cases you can request an endorsement if that happens. But by and large, the water environment is really important to the Agri-Environment Climate Scheme. There's a lot of points available for it. It is a competitive scheme. So where possible, it's always good to build around some of those options.
Can I just jump in as well to say, when we were doing all this, we realised that people didn't really understand about what this protection was or how to build it. So as part of that, we also created a few outputs. And so there is a SEPA design guide that tells you how to design all the different types of bank protection, sustainable bank protection. And it also includes the rules. So we've made it what we call the GBR, General Binding Rule. And that has some conditions that you have to comply with. And if you comply with those conditions, then you do not need a license. So that's in there as well. We also created a few videos, and that went out to five of the different sites and talked to the different landowners. And so they basically talked about their experience and showed what the sustainable protection looked like sort of quite soon after construction. But I think they're a really good idea to get an idea around, what do they actually do and what does that look like?
What does it look like, I suppose? How much space it takes up and things like that.
Yeah, so you can go and look into them. They're really useful. But at SEPA, we're always happy to field questions about this because we're much happier dealing with them than a whole lot of massive, rock armor going into these rivers. So always happy to help in whatever way we can. Mm-hmm. And just to say, some of the Rivers Trusts have been doing great work all across the country. So getting in touch with your local Rivers Trust might potentially be quite a good way.
I'll put links to all the documents and websites and things that we've discussed in the podcast on the podcast page so people can easily get access to them. So obviously a lot of management decisions and putting on farm will be heavily relied on the cost and availability of materials. What has your experience been while doing these trials or other projects?
Well, we were asked quite early on how much does this cost and the importance of this. So actually, as part of the review, I undertook a full analysis of costs for the different types of approaches and got as many examples as I could. And so what we found is that using sustainable bank protection tends to be quite a lot cheaper, and it's partly linked to where you're getting your material from. So gabion and rockstone is usually between 220 to 280 pounds a metre, and some of the sustainable bank protection using sort of whole trees could be down to 27 pounds a metre, so much, much cheaper. But again, if you do have trees locally available on your farm, all you have to do is get those to site. It's not such a big deal, whereas having to source quarried stone and then transport it to your site can be far more expensive. So there's some real benefits cost-wise, particularly with the big storms we've had, trying to use windfall, that foresters don't really know what to do with. And in fact, there's been loads. A big chunk was just put in on the Willow Water, actually using windfall from Storm Arrowin. So not the one we just had, but the previous large windy storm. And that's been really successful. That's to protect buried infrastructure. So some pretty serious stuff that's gone in there.
And also using the type of material, you did mention like invasive species and stuff earlier on. How can people make sure that the material going in, I'm going to use the word clean, but is appropriate for the location?
Yeah, I guess with trees, generally it is appropriate. I mean, a lot of our invasive species tend to be sort of flowering plants. A lot of pine is used just because that's what's freely available, and actually they blow over quite easily. And so, we've not really had an issue with that as much, I don't think. But just, I guess, being careful that you're not sourcing your tree is from an area where there's a whole lot of Japanese knotweed, I think would be a probably good starter for tin. So just being aware of what's in the environment and how that might impact the site you're transporting it to.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, Ellen. I mean, a lot of farmers I speak to will raise the issue of particularly Japanese knotweed and Himalayan balsam. You know, that's the last thing they want to encourage. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the root systems of these plants will be fairly shallow, I would think, and over time will be quite damaging to a riverbank.
Yeah, I mean, we've not looked at any specifically that have those covers, I guess, so it wasn't really part of... but yeah, I could imagine it's not... Yeah, they're not great anywhere they are. If you have them, try and get rid of them, I would say. But yeah, and I guess they do get shaded out with time, I would have thought. So once you do have a more established sort of shrubs and vegetation on your bank, you're not going to get these sun-loving plants underneath them.
It was also really interesting that the GBRs, you can actually do some of this without having to get a license.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so we created a new GBR because previously people did have to get a license. We realised that takes a long time. So, yeah, there are some conditions that you have to comply with. And if you comply with those conditions, then you can just crack on and do it. You don't have to come to us. I mean, you're welcome to come to us if you need any advice. We're really happy to talk about it. But, you know, you're allowed to just go and start doing this work.
Plus, you don't even need to tell SEPA.
You don't even need to tell SEPA. Yeah. It's quite... rare. It's putting a lot of trust into landowners, but I think we thought it was so important, mm-hmm. to be honest, and we thought that people needed to be able to do that and to make these decisions. If it's useful, some of the conditions you have to comply with are things like that as the water flows through the arrangement, it flexes and bends and, you know, impedes, it cushions the bank from the force of the river. So it's talking about keeping it rough, not just putting bare logs along the bank. That doesn't comply. You need to maintain those, you know, have those branches and have that rough face. Making sure it's securely attached to the bank so it doesn't wash down and get stuck on the bridge downstream. And again, in our good practice guide, we've got some really good ways of attaching that. And finally, making sure that it's graded smoothly into the bank line.
Oh, so then you don't get that hard surface like that farmer experienced. Yeah.
Yeah, because if you do just put bare logs on, it's actually no real different from putting a whole lot of boulders. Yeah, so just being aware that it's not just using the trees that's good, but it's actually the roughness and you know, how that is that really makes it effective.
It's maybe a good time just to reflect, Helen, but... erosion will happen in a riverbank. I mean, the river will naturally change over time.
It's
we're not talking about eliminating that change, but kind of softening the blow of it and kind of working with the river a little bit more.
I think it's looking at the river in your land and working out where can we let it adjust a bit and where would it be really terrible if it adjusts, and actually using these approaches there. When we do have we're seeing way more floods, they're much bigger and they're more frequent. And so rivers will get bigger because they have to get bigger to accommodate more flow. And if we stop them from being able to do that, we can actually increase flooding because your channel capacity is less. So less water will fit in your channel and you'll get more flooding your land. So we do need to think about how rivers adjust. And also as part of maintaining a diverse arrangement of habitats, actually channel adjustment and habitat turnover is really important. And otherwise rivers can really get sort of stuck in space and they can become far more simplified and they just don't have the diversity of habitats that you'd normally see. So it's trying to think about where can we allow the river to adjust? How can we sort of buffer that adjustment with some natural vegetation and slow that adjustment? And then what spaces can we actually not allow adjustment because it would really be detrimental to the farm and the land and then using this approach at those locations?
Yeah, I think just going back to the Agri-Environment Climate Scheme and maybe to waylay some of the concerns that farmers will have when we talk about riverbank restoration, farmers often feel, well, I need my livestock to get access to the river. They need the water from the river, obviously. The Agri-Environment Climate Scheme accommodates for that. We have management options for what's classed as alternative watering. So if you feel that you need to exclude livestock, there is capital support there for alternative watering in the forms of water troughs, pipes, abstraction points, you name it. So don't please don't be put off if you're listening to this and thinking, well, my livestock need access to a river. There are ways around that.
Thank you both for joining us today. It's been a really interesting discussion, and I just think it's so interesting what you can actually do with, especially like material that has come from like a storm disaster, and being able to recycle that on farm to something positive. I think it's a really, really good way of recycling material on farm, and to have the benefit of being able to protect land and potentially have all the other additional biodiversity improvements in your farm and on within the river, which is so crucial moving forward. And thank you for joining us today. We'll save all the links to documents and guidance notes that have been discussed throughout this podcast on the webpage. If you've enjoyed listening, please like, subscribe or follow our podcast wherever you listen to them. And please get in touch if you'd like to find out more. You can listen back to all previous episodes in this series and other podcasts we produce for Farming Water Scotland on any podcast provider. Farming Water Scotland is funded by Scottish Government and delivered by SAC Consulting in partnership with SEPA to help farmers and land managers reduce diffuse pollution risks and benefit the farm business.